This is Gary Wakefield, and you're listening to Queer Life Stories. Our podcast is recorded in La Truita, home of the Palawa people. We acknowledge the traditional owners of country, their diversity, histories and knowledge, and their continuing connections to land and community. We also acknowledge LGBTIQA+ advocates, friends and allies whose courage and strengths have helped to make this a more just society for lesbian, gay, bisexual, gender diverse and intersex populations and their families.
So my name's Pusse Poppins. I'm Tasmania's premier drag performer. I identify as gross. I identify as in drag, she, her, out of drag. I'm pretty gender fluid, so I like to identify as he, him, she, her, they, them. I'm pretty fluid. Happy to go with the flow, see how I feel every day.
Yeah, let's go right back to the beginning.
Oh, okay. So when a man and a woman love each other very much, they have unprotected sex. So my dad nutted in my mum, good, in the late 80s. But my family originally is from Lebanon. So my family immigrated in the 60s to Australia. And my dad's side decided to kind of like migrate to rural New South Wales, middle of Whoop Whoop. It's probably like 6 hours south of Brizzy inland. Mum's side's from Sydney. And then, so I grew up in rural New South Wales, in a very Lebanese, very Catholic household, which is, you know, being very queer and very flamboyant is, as the eldest grandson, was obviously the favourite at family gatherings. But, so I grew up in rural New South Wales and was there for 18 years before I moved to Sydney to start studying. And moving to Sydney was the best thing that I've ever done too, because it kind of got me out of my hometown and realised, hey, there's a big world where I feel accepted, feeling seen and feeling like the other community that I can, like, lean on and not feel as ostracised and lonely in a town of, like, 1,200 people. So, 12,000 people, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Said that you were the queer, flamboyant one at family gatherings. Was that always the case from really young?
No. So, what I found was when I was closeted, because obviously it's like I didn't know how my parents would take it when I came out, and I didn't know how my friends would take it, and of course they didn't take it well and my family didn't take it well, but I needed to kind of be somewhat self-protective. But it's about, I kind of was very closet, so I was a different person in my teens as I am now. Completely, I did a complete 180, which is great. I finally found myself and it took a very long time to get there, but yeah. I think I did a lot of, I do drama, I do bits and pieces, I'm studying, I want to be a doctor, I want to do kind of like go to university and higher education and things like that, but I was also very like, okay, let's not talk about sexuality, let's kind of like lead that away and just kind of, I think that's where a lot of my humour came from as well, as that kind of self-protective stuff, being like, oh my god, if I can get a joke into it and distract, then I'll be absolutely fine and no one will get to the nitty-gritty, until it was maybe my, like, when I was in my grade 10 years, which is like 16, my friend started asking, and I was like, fuck it, I'm just going to say it, I'm not going to keep lying, but still didn't let my parents know until I moved out, just so at least I knew I had a place to stay and come home to afterwards, so yeah.
So what was childhood like? Were you only child?
No, even though I act like it, I'm not. I'm the eldest, and I have a younger sister who's 2 years younger. And it was a very interesting dynamic in the household, because you could see, I could see the favouritism from my sister. This has turned into a therapy session so immediately quickly, but I could see the favouritism from my sister quite a bit, even though I felt like, and I am more successful and in many different aspects. Not that it's a competition, but I still felt there was a lot of favouritism from very early on. So I was kind of like doing a lot of that eldest child kind of like, I need to prove myself, I need to find myself. And also it was one of those things paving a way for, I was the first person in my family to go to university. No, I lied, my uncle. My uncle went to university to be an accountant, but that doesn't count. Accountants aren't people. But they were, I kind of went and did something like that kind of pink collar kind of job, rather than everyone else who was doing the blue collar-esque style, like, I'm going to own a business, go into business, everyone's doing business, so business or accounting. So I did something in healthcare, which made it kind of like a bit of a shift for the family to kind of have someone who is a health professional in it.
Mm. What did your parents do?
So mum was a stay-at-home mum, and dad worked like six jobs when he was young, and then he ended up owning a shoe business. And then now he owns news agencies back home. So it's a lot of like terrible work ethic passed down from him to me. So that's where I'm kind of seeing he does like 18 hour days as well. And then 7 days a week. And he yells at me for doing the same. And I'm like, well, mirroring. So.
You said you came out around 16. What was...
I came out to my friends at 16. And then I came out to my family when I came home at 18.
So who was the first person that you told? Do you remember that?
No, I don't, actually. I really don't. It's so long ago. It's probably like nearly 16, 17 years ago when I did. Yeah, no, it's nearly 20 years, actually. It is 20 years next year. Jesus, yeah. I can do maths. I can't remember. I remember I reached a point where I was like, I'm sick of lying. So if someone, the next person who asks me, am I gay or am I queer, I'm going to just say yes. I'm going to tell them the truth. And then I think it was a bit of a shock because it's one of those things, small town, everyone's just like chat, chat, chat. Mm. It's like, oh, and it's funny that I don't know what it is about young kids, but they just know before you do. And I knew I was gay from like five. I had a crush on Darren Hayes in the Truly Madly Deeply video. I was five watching it being like, oh, okay, I can get around that. And then, so I knew from a very early age and then... Now I'm just, and then I was just like, I just need to like get out of my own head. And there's also with all those like early, like late 90s, early 2000s kind of TV shows, they show people getting kicked out and this incredibly dramatized version of what happens, which still does happen, to be fair. It still does happen. And I know a lot of people have had it happen. But it's one of those things, it's like, okay, it's not as dramatic as for everyone as it is on television, but you still have to be, you don't know how people are going to react. That's the. Worst part about it. But yeah, I can't remember. I remember when I told my parents, we were in the car. I came back home and they asked me, because I was staying with my aunt at the time and I had a friend over, a man friend, but not like in that way. He was a friend, but we kind of ended up like hooking up. But he came over and we're kind of just like watching TV and stuff. And then my parents were like, who is this person? And I'm like, he's a friend. They're like, okay. And then I went quiet and then dad was just like, are you gay? And I'm like, now or never. And I was like, yep. Yes, I am, and just went quiet in the car on the way home. And not that it was a very long drive. It was like maybe a 5 minute drive. I was like, it was the longest fucking drive because they're both dead silent. And I'm like, okay, this is going to go down like a ton of bricks, which was fine. It was, I think I went back for my sister's graduation.
So did you talk about it when you got home? Like,
no.
Was anything else ever said about it?
Dead silent. And then I overheard my mum and my dad talking privately, but I could overhear them. And then she's like, what do we do? And dad's just like, what can we do? Like, it is what it is. He's no different. They were just kind of like freaking out. And then I think that night was the graduation night and I made a joke at the dinner table. And mum was like, I wish you weren't joking. I wish you were joking about something else. And I'm just like, oh, you can't. Burning hell. No, it's fine. So I was just like, oh my God, trauma. But it's fine. Like, I did a show back home at Christmas. So I've never done a show, and my parents were here when I was performing, and they knew about it afterwards. And it was good to tell them. I used Dame Edna as an example because I knew I wanted to get into acting. I'm like, oh, I'm doing stage stuff, dressed as a woman. I'm doing drag. And they're like, oh. And I'm like Dame Edna. I'm like, oh, like comedy and this. I'm like, yeah. So it made it palpable, like even though they're a horrible, Dame Edna's a horrible person. Horribly transphobic asshole. But, so they were kind of fine with drag more than they'll fine with the queer stuff initially until they realized I was working a lot and doing a lot. And then they refused to kind of see shows. Even when they were in town, they wouldn't really come. And then I bit the bullet and I went home and I'm like, fuck it. A venue was doing drag bingos back home in the small town. And I'm like, who's cutting my fucking grass? So then they reached out to me to kind of promote a different event. And I'm like, are you booking me? And they didn't. So I was like, fine, whatever. But they're like, if you're in town, we'd love to have you do a bingo. And we did. And it sold out very early, like 3 months in advance. We nearly sold out, which was unheard of. And then we ended up doing another Dragons Sip and Draw kind of thing 2 days. And that sold out quite quickly. And it went amazingly. And my parents came. That was only like, what, 4 months ago? Like, yeah, it was wild and it was scary. And I didn't take any Valium. I didn't take any Gastrostop. So I was really just like, give me all the drinks. And I had like old teachers there and it was Christmas. So everyone was home for the holidays and I had family there. And it was, and my parents and my sister. And my sister's been notoriously quiet, like not completely accepting of everything as well, which is fine, okay. Which they'll deny, but you know. The axe doesn't remember, the tree does. But yeah. That mum apparently laughed the whole time except for 6 jokes. She was just like, this is far too much. And I think I know exactly which jokes it was, because I'm pretty sure there was a priest joke, a Catholic church joke I made, and mum was like, that's too much, which it was. I think it was like a molesting reference or something like that. And then there was one about fisting, which happens a lot. And then I didn't know which one. And then there was a really mean one about a local girl who got rejected off The Voice. Everyone was, that was really mean. And I'm like, it was funny. Everyone laughed. It's fine. It's a joke, not a dick. Don't take it so hard. So, but dad left like 3/4 of the way through. Saying he had a leg cramp. And I'm like, yeah, you're a bilateral amputee. Where's the leg cramp? He's not. But I was just like, whatever. Whatever.
And did you talk after that?
I was like, how'd you like it? They're like, it's fine. And then they went to bed. But mind you, it was like 10:30 and dad gets up at 4 to 5 o'clock to go to work. So, and then I think I saw him the next day at work. I went in and I'm like, what do you think? He's like, I thought you're going to be meaner to me. And I'm like, you asked me not to. You asked me to behave myself. So I did. So it was fine. It was very liberating actually doing it, because I did my usual, like, let's do a learning like lecture at the end of because yeah. I do, like, as much as all my shows are, like, disgusting or, like, lewd or mean or crude, at the end, which I always do, is, like, okay, thank you so much for supporting queer events, but it just doesn't stop by, like, giving it, like, this. You have to continue being a better ally and kind of educating, especially a lot of the straight people, about what it is for allyship and how important it is, especially when we did the drag story time and I was, like, when everyone found out about how much hate and, like, threats and violence that was pushed my way, everyone's, like, that's terrible. And I'm, like, I felt like I was alone, so you need to open your mouth and, like, show the support, not just be like, oh, yeah, I like it. I'm like, no, you have to be active. You have to be better. And after having one of those really big speeches, and I was like, I felt like I was alone back home, and I felt like I was so isolated, and I was the only queer person in the village, which is such a stereotype, but I literally felt like that. I'm like, there's no one around here like me. Afterwards, everyone was, like, coming up and, like, give me hugs, and the chef came out and gave me a really big hug and was crying. I'm like, oh God, what did I upset you with? And then they were like, no, my child's trans and I'm really struggling because I don't know what to do to be better and how can I be a better ally? And like, it just, I didn't realize how intense it is being in a rural community and isolated like this. One of those things that just, it's those reminders about using my platform for good as well as the constant evil that I do. That's what the ACL thinks, at least. It's constant evil.
Grew up Catholic. Was that a big part of growing up?
Yep. I was at church every Saturday night. So we're Maronite Catholic. So we were at church every Saturday night, rain, hail, shine, unless I was deathly ill or away. But even when we went out of town, my parents managed to find a church of some variety and go sit there. I was on the altar boy and I went to Catholic school. So it was quite a big part of my life is... being in the church and religion. So obviously going to Catholic school has really shaped me as the person that I am today, if you can't tell. It's not something that I'm as deeply invested in at the moment now, especially because I find that a lot of the Catholic church beliefs do not resonate with me as a person, and I don't feel like I'm as welcomed in the church as I was when I was closeted. So, which is... it's upsetting, but I found a higher calling in community work and being a community advocate, if that's a way to say it. So,
yeah.
And do things for the community and go in outreach and go to smaller regional spaces and be openly queer and be invisible. And that's really where, I guess, we started working together back in the, 3.5 years ago, I think. It was just after COVID. Because I've been doing drag for about 11 years. And when I moved to Tasmania and really just kind of like fell into drag, I saw a lot of myself in the queer regional community, not just in Hobart, outside all over the state. And when I did stuff in like Launceston and I first moved to Launceston, that's when I first moved to Tassie. I was in Lonnie first, which is, incredible. And there was so much of the community, I'm like, I can see myself in this. And then when I reached out to you, Gary, when I went to when we did the Pride in the Parks right after COVID, I think it was like 2021.
Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I really just want to like go and do more for the community and do more for, especially for regional areas where there's not a lot of visibility and queer spaces, and trying to like make sure that there's queer events that are outside of Hobart, because it's so hard to travel. 4 hours is a long drive just to go to a queer club or a queer event. And coming up to Ulverston and doing Pride in the Park, it was insane. And you, especially when you were like, there's no budget, we can't pay you. I'm like, I don't care, I'm doing this. You're going to get someone doing something, I don't give a shit. And
that was drag story time.
It was the first drag story time I did, and that was well before the death threat one. And it was incredible just seeing like 400 people. It was like 300, 400 people. It was insane. There was so many people. Everyone was losing their mind because they'd never seen a drag queen in person. And I had my team of like my ex-producer and my friend who were driving while I was doing my makeup between Oatlands in the car. And my makeup was so average. It was so damaged. It was so ugly. And everyone's like, you look beautiful. And I'm like, it gets better, I promise. Let me like not hit every pothole in my Toyota Corolla.
But it made such an impact to the people in Ulverston and the queer community up here. Oh. Like, it made such an impact. And to see a queer performer talking to kids in a public space, like, that was a lot for me.
And that's the thing that really resonates with me as well, because when I grew up, I didn't have any form of visibility except for Carson Kressley and Bob Down on TV. And I'm like, they're great personalities. They're not every gay personality. And in the early 90s, early late 90s, 2000s, those queer characters are very one note joke, but you don't see everything. And that's where I was like, if I had better visibility when I was a... and the other one was Queer as Folk. And so I used to sneak watch Queer as Folk and be horrified because it was so graphic and so violent. I'm like, I'm going to either be bashed, or I'm going to get HIV or AIDS, or I'm going to get this, or I'm going to be I'm going to be single forever and I'm never going to find a partner. Or if I do have a partner, they're going to like get bashed or something like that. And it was so, it's dramatized versions of what it was. And now that I'm going out to more regional communities and doing a lot of like regional kind of like travel work, it's so important to have that visibility. And that's where I saw a lot there. I'm like, I knew it. But then when I saw it firsthand, I'm like, this is what I need to do more. And then that's when we started doing more events with Northwest Pride, which was absolutely incredible.
You come to Tassie after university?
Yeah, so I worked in Sydney for a year as a physiotherapist, and I got sick of it. I was traveling 2.5 hours to go to work. I was managing like 4 aged care facilities. I was like, I need a change. I was caring for my grandparents, and my grandmother passed away 2 years after I was caring for her, and it just kind of, it really shook me quite a bit. And then I was like, I need a bit of a sea change. And there was a 4-month locum job at the Launceston General, and I was like, 4 months, never been to Tassie before, why not? I've always wanted to travel and work. And I came down here, and I had a friend from university who was at Launceston, which made it easier. It wasn't like I was completely alone. But it was actually funny that I did the two phone interviews, and I put my straight voice on when I'm like, blah, 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 blah. And then I was like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, Andrew, and I love physio and cardiorespiratory and blah. And then he calls my friend who was like, because come to my office, like, what is, he's like, tell me about your friend who from Sydney is like, oh, very good cardiorespiratory. He really likes cardiorespiratory work and blah, blah, blah. And then the manager was like, yeah, it sounds like a real bloke's bloke. It sounds like he'll get on well with the guys down here. And my friend was like, he will get down well with the guys here. He really will. And then he calls me afterwards, like, he thinks you're straight. I'm like, I put my straight voice on. And it took him 3 months when I came down here to realize. And it took because the old manager who managed a different area, he's also openly queer. And we're at a hospital ball, and I was in like a magenta like suit jacket, and we're dancing a Vogue on the dance floor, and then one of the assistants was like, god, they're out gaying each other. And then the manager was like, they're gay. And then one of the seniors was like, you're a fucking idiot. Blind and deaf people know this. What is wrong with you? And he's like, oh, okay. So funny. So I came down for a 4-month locum, and that turned into a year contract, and I got promoted, and I got another job, and then I moved out, and then it just kept getting extended until and it's been 11 years now.
Yeah, right.
So I moved down to Hobart for love, regrettably. Worst mistake of my life. No, I'm kidding. I gave up my PhD thesis. I would have had a PhD by now if I stayed in Launceston, but I wouldn't have done all the drag stuff if I didn't move down to Hobart. So there's a silver lining with everything. And now I'm just incredibly rich from doing drag because, you know, it makes so much money from doing drag. I'm rolling my eyes for people who can't see because there's no visual recording of this. But, yeah, no.
When and how did you get into drag?
Fell into it. And it's such a stereotype, but it's gaga. It was so gaga. I've always loved performing. I've always loved theatre and stage work and all of that stuff and costume making and being creative and just using my hands. It works with the physio job. It works with it. I just have always been good with my hands. And I basically started doing performance work and things like that. And then I've always wanted to kind of have the idea of like doing this like massive performance-esque kind of thing on stage. And just like, I love musicals and I love just being showing like and dance and do all this kind of amazing stuff. And then Gaga came out with Just Dance and I was like, okay. And then I saw on Rove and that changed my opinion. I'm like, oh, it's a generic pop song. But then I saw her like with like all this technology and all this like, and she kind of combined art and technology and pop music and all this in this really fantastic way. And I'm like, oh my goodness. And then I was like, oh, this is amazing. And then I heard a random song from The Fame, the album, the song was called The Fame. And I'm like, I'm really obsessed with this song. And I'm like, who sings it? I'm like, oh, Gaga sings it. And then I looked at the album and a Poker Face came out. I'm like, oh, I like really like these three songs. And I listened to the first album and I was like, I'm obsessed. Started watching a lot of her stuff, all of her live performances where she had all this amazing tech and costumes. And I was just so creative. And I'm like, oh, I just want to do a Gaga based drag show in Sydney. And then my partner at the time, was like, I'm a drag queen. You can never be able to do drag. Mind you, he's like in his mid-40s and lives with his parents. And I can't even for the life of me tell him his drag name because he has never worked in the strip in Sydney a day in his life. So I'm like, fuck you. But they were like, and it's true. I remember seeing my first drag show in Sydney. And it was Courtney Act live singing Poker Face. And if anyone knows Courtney Act, she's just absolutely stunning, so lovely and very talented. And I was there. I'm like, I can't do this. And then it took me a very long time to kind of come back around to seeing. And I actually started watching Drag Race early on. It was like season 4, season 5. I started watching it as it was coming out. And I'm like, oh, it's not just. And Sydney's very, like, all the drag queens on the strip are pretty, talented, girl group, dancing. I'm like, okay, that's fine. That's not completely me as a person. I want to be a bit artsy. I want to be a bit more political. I want to be a bit funnier. I want to be just a bit more weird and camp. And then I started seeing, oh, I can actually see more of myself in drag from Drag Race than I did on the Sydney Strip. And then I was like, maybe I can do this. And then I started doing like Gaga, dressing up as Gaga for Halloween. And I've always done that for a while. So then I was like, I moved to Tassie and I'm like, my first gig outside of putting on a show at a Halloween party for all my friends to just basically force them to watch. I was stood up on a date near the old Lazy Butterfly in Launceston, the first queer venue in Tassie, one of the first queer venues ages ago. And one of the first. They had the Royal Oak and then the Lazy Butterfly was around for so long doing drag shows. And my friends took me there ages and I was watching the drag performers and I was like, camp, but I also don't see my style of drag there and I want to kind of show something a little bit different for here. So then I was like, I'm a drag queen, put me on. They're like, okay, 2 weeks. And I'm like, shit, I need to bring stuff down from Sydney. I'm only here for a short time. And then I did two numbers, Gaga, of course, they're all Gaga based and dancing and massive costumes, 12-inch heels, light up crystal disco sticks and 7-minute mega mixes. And it was the busiest night. Because I called a lot of my friends in, but they were like, this is the busiest night we've had in ages. And I got like $300 in tips, and including my fee. And they were just like, here's your money. I'm like, oh my God, it's so much. And they were angry because they're like, I never got tipped this much. And then like, can you come back? I'm like, yeah. And then I started working with the diversity group in Launceston and started doing like shows. And that's when I met Barry Bothways and started doing like drag shows at for events and things like that. And then, yeah, I moved down to Hobart and stopped for 12 months while I was with my partner because I didn't like it. And then once we broke up, I ended up entered a competition, Drag Nation, and came second, even though I should have came first. That's when I did the human centipede number. I came out dressed as the human centipede and lip-synced to Stuck in the Middle with You. And everyone was, all the judges were like, who are you? What is wrong with your brain? This is insane. And I'm like, thank you. That's that's what I do best. But I was very green. I was very green. I needed a lot of work in that meantime. But it was a lot of fun, and that's when I started working at Flamingos and started practicing and doing more, going out and drag every night and every weekend, sorry. And yeah, just started kind of building myself up. And now I'm, since Flamingo shut, I started up duties and all my bingos and shows all around the state, and just trying to diversify and yeah, keep it camp, keep it pushing.
Do you want to talk about the Launceston drag story time?
Yes. How are you processing that as well? Because it affected all of us in different ways.
It was a lot. Yeah, I was quite angry when I saw the TERFs had organised this protest outside the library for your event. And so Northwest Pride, I got really angry, and I was like, we need to do something, and we need to create a rainbow shield to protect these kids that are going to this fun event from seeing all this hate and negativity. So
it was wild. Yeah. Like, I knew there was going to be backlash. I didn't realize the American component of the politics was going to be so trickled down here. Mm. So the library and I were talking about this for ages, I think we had a 3-year planning process of like, how can we do this? Cause it happens all over. We've done this in the state before. Like, we've done it. It's not like it's the first drag story time. I've done 3 without an issue in Ulverston of all places. Like, it was wild. So we did it in the first drag story time in a public library in Tasmanian history in Launceston of all places, which was amazing. They were so supportive, and I have a lot of respect for the whole team there. But the Australian Christian Lobby kind of heard about it and just were like, let's do a smear campaign. And then it just went bigger than Ben-Hur. My parents found out before I could even tell them because my cousin followed a basketballer or the Andrew Bogut or someone on Twitter, and he called me a pedophile, a child groomer on like this, and was just, it just kind of went like all those nasty like right-wing senators kind of picked it up, and it just went absolutely crazy. So then they found out because he saw it, and he told my sister, who told my parents. So then when I found out how, because I didn't know it, I knew it was bad, but I didn't know it was as bad as it was until I logged back into Twitter, because the guy who was sued by Peter Dutton for defamation and failed, Shane Bazzi, followed me on Instagram. And I'm like, why is Shane Bazzi following me on Instagram? I'm like, I'm going to go and he didn't post anything on Instagram. I'm like, might I go on Twitter, see what's going on? And then I was like, oh, this is a lot worse than I thought it was. And I was getting like threats every now and then. And then as I was getting closer, probably like 3 weeks out, I was getting death threats every hour on nearly every platform. I could see my analytics for my website, so I can see where people are viewing it, how long they're viewing it for, and I'll get notifications every time, like someone in Hobart's having a look, someone in, and it was all like America, America, America. Someone in the US is looking at my website, someone's doing this, and someone here, and they're on it for extended periods, which means they were like fishing for, they're this, cut it down, let's find weaknesses. And then they started attacking every single way of communication through my website, my email, my Facebook, Instagram, like messages publicly. There was just every hour there was something. And then it kind of got to the point where they're threatening to come to my house and like attack my family. And they're like, we know you live here, so we're going to come and find you here. And so then I had to get the police involved. And that was a week out of the event when it started to ramp up more, which was pretty intense. And it was just, and I couldn't, I kept quite quiet during the whole thing because they kept doing like things in the paper and they wanted me to comment. And I'm like, I don't think I need to because it's either going to inflame it or they could work it into a way that's going to misconstrue, which ABC did. And I'm furious with the ABC. They asked for me for a thing and I said, go to the Launceston media department for a statement, which they didn't. And then they went to Michael Ferguson and Louise Elliott to make statements. And they were just like, I'm not taking my kids here. This is not appropriate. And I'm like, your government backed this. Everyone, Jeremy Rockcliffe is very supportive of this. And then he spoke out against it and I was furious. And Jeremy knew I was furious because I know Jeremy and he knew I was furious about how, because after that ABC article, it got worse. And after so Louise and Michael's comments just really amped it up a bit more and made it, and we got probably like 50 staff members got direct threats from the library after that as well. And of course I got the brunt of it because I was the poster child of it. It was insane. And then I had people messaging saying that the Nazis are going to picket it and there's going to be a big protest, and I'm like, oh, fucking hell. And then, so it was quite insane, and it was a very, like, dark moment in my life because I've knew that a lot, it was very much like, okay, my drag affects me directly. It's not going to affect anyone else. And when they started threatening my kids and my partner and my house and my family, I was like, okay, this is beyond me now, and they're going to a different level of being low, and rather than they're trying to just shake me. So I stopped doing it. And then we got there, and obviously there were Nazi protesters and TERF protesters and stuff, which was really intense and scary. We had to really negotiate how we get in and out of the venue safely, because I was like, I don't want them to know where my car is, because then I've had friends in Melbourne who've done events where afterwards, but I'm glad I didn't drive there, because they had friends in Melbourne who were like, we found your license plate, we've paid someone this much at Vic Roads to find your address, so we're going to come and find you now. And so the police officer got involved with that one. But yeah, it was like a lot of that stuff, and it was made it quite hard and challenging to even feel safe. But at the end, afterwards, I felt it was, like, even during, actually, we had two protesters have tickets and sit there filming the whole time. And we're like, you need to stop filming. That's not appropriate. Like, everyone else is filming. I'm like, they have kids. You're two adults by yourself. This is weird. And the police were great there, but then they left after the event. And when I came out and said thank you, then they were like yelling out my government name and being like, we're going to find you, we're going to get you. And I was just like, all these like really direct threats of like, and I had to be ushered back in, and I had a full breakdown inside because I was like, great, this is just horrible people, horrible missing guidance. And even afterwards, my parents, when I told them, I'm probably looking at lawyers to talk about defamation or things like that. And Dad's like, well, it's your own fault for doing something inappropriate, which I was like, what did you think I was doing? And it was just it was hard. But the thing is, as much as I'm like reliving, like every time I talk about it, it's reliving the trauma, it's nothing to compare to what trans people are living like every day at the moment, because they're the current butt of the way, like the target basically at the moment now, where people can't even live their lives. I'm lucky I can take my wig off and have relative anonymity. I got recognized today in Devonport. They're like, how's the show? You came to the show last night. I'm like, hi. Don't yell at me. But
did you think about taking the wig off permanently after that?
I did for like a very brief moment, until I had a really good therapy session and my therapist was like, okay, you have two options. You either stop doing what you're doing and let them win, or you keep going and you fight back harder. And I'm like, yeah, good perspective. So it gave me a really good perspective to be like, nah, I need to not let domestic terrorism win. And it really was. They'll just do it using terroristic strategies to push their agenda and stop me from feeling safe, which is terrorism. So terrorism are not just my family in the middle of Lebanon blowing things up. That was a joke. My family are not terrorists. But it's a form of like using manipulation and force tactics to push agendas that people don't agree with.
So let's change direction for a little bit and
poo jokes. Dick sucking.
I know that's your forte.
Yeah, exactly. Someone who talks as much shit, they must really be obsessed with it.
No, I want to talk about what your love life has looked like.
Oh, this is interesting. So my first it's hard because my first relationship was not really a relationship, because it was one of those, like, I'm dating a girl for 3 days at school. Then we broke off. It's like, it's not a relationship. And it's funny because, like, going to Sydney and feeling queer and kind of getting the community, a lot of my exposure was in dating websites, not even apps. That's how old I am. We had, like, websites where you talk to people that you don't know, and I lost my virginity in a hotel room in Sydney with someone I didn't know. I met for the first time. And it was that. And that's the thing about like visibility. Cause like, if I knew better, I would do better. And I did a lot of unsafe things as a newly queer person being on my own in the city. And so I dated, who was my first boyfriend? Oh, the first partner was the one that told me I couldn't do drag. That was my first relationship. And it was a good 2 years all together. And it's me being so inexperienced and so much. Trying to get approval from people, being like, oh, this is the best I'm going to do. I guess I'll stick with this. And having very low self-esteem and low self-worth and not really knowing really much about myself that early. I was probably like 19, 20, dating a 30-year-old. And it was interesting because I put up with a lot of stuff that I would absolutely not put up with now. And that's the thing about relationships. You learn and you grow and you're like, actually, I don't want to do this. I do want to do this. And I had a couple of other relationships, like I had smaller relationships in Launceston, one with like a lovely French man who was working in the state, who's lovely and super lovely, but it lasted very short period as well because obviously it was like he's traveling and only here for a couple of months. And then I had my big relationship with where I moved to Hobart with my partner at the time, and that was the first time I lived with someone, and it was a big step because I had to move everything that I had in my other house or sell it and give up like my stable permanent job and give up my PhD thesis and give up my friends and a really good hospital system that I really enjoyed working on. And one of my physio mentors still works up there, and she was the manager at the time, and she was just such an inspiration. She was one of those like power lesbian couples where they just like run the same, just do everything so effortlessly, and just gave me such a good drive and showing like you can't, and she was such a good mentor, not just professionally but also personally. And I still message her every now and then, even though she's incredibly famous because she's finished her PhD thesis and it was one of the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere, and her trial changed a lot, and I worked on that trial too, and it's the PhD trial, and it changed a lot of the way that we practice physio in the surgical setting, and she just gave me a lot of like motivation to like just push more. So I went down for this relationship, and I was, once again, the relationship was not something that I would put up with now. Like, I never met my partner at the time's mum because every time he was just like, oh, she doesn't really like it. So when she would come over, I'd have to either hide in the bedroom or leave. Yeah, I know. Yeah, Gary just rolled his eyes, and I agree. Like, back then, I was like, this is the best I can do. And, like, he was the first partner I took home to my family to meet because I was like, this is going to be forever. But, like, he was like, I don't really like drag. His friends were very religious, and, like, they all met in the church, even though he wasn't very religious. And his parents, I remember his dad came home and was like one day being like, is Andrew poor? He drives like a Holden Astra. And he's just like, no, he earns probably like four times as much as me, but he's saving for a house and the car's not a high priority because they all drove like Beamers and stuff. And I was just like, okay, great. This family is interesting. And then it was one of those relationships where I was like, he woke up one day and he's like, yeah, I don't really love you anymore. And I'm like, cool, well, I'll move out then. I'm fucked. So moved out for as quick as I could. He gave me like a month to move out, which is fair. But that's what pushed me into drag. I started doing the competition after that, and I was like, no, he didn't want me to do drag. I'm fucking going to show him how to do drag. And then the next relationship was even worse. I felt harder, but then he ghosted me. It was a very controlling kind of relationship, a very narcissistic, like unintentionally dom sub relationship, which I, reflecting back, I was like, no, it's not something that I would have agreed to if I didn't think if I had more self-worth. I think the kicker in that last relationship, which really changed me a lot as a person, was I was very sick. I was doing drag a lot. I was getting better at it. In between, like, I won a state competition in between those relationships, and a lot of, I was like, you know, this, I'm going to be, after the relationship where I moved down to Hobart, I was like, Gaga had this saying which really stuck with me. It's like, men come and go, but your job's never going to wake up one morning and tell you it doesn't love you anymore. And I'm like, that kind of stuck with me for a while. So I'm like, I'm not going to compromise my performance or my work for someone else again. I'm going to stick to my guns and trust my gut, because my gut's, even though I have horrible IBS, it's normally pretty sharp. And then when I was really sick and I was working, I was doing dark mofo events, and they were one of the best installations at Night Mass the first year at the Hanging Garden opened up. And like the head of dark mofo was like, that was incredible. Like, it was better than what we expected. You really killed it. Like, you'll always have work with us. And it was just so incredible to work with such amazing artistic kind of people. And while I was really sick, I was literally on like chemo strength, anti-nausea meds, feeds, and I couldn't have anything more than like chicken and a sip of water and I'll be sick. And I lost about 20 kilos, which back then I had nothing. I was very emaciated and my gut stopped working. And One day my partner just stopped answering my calls and stopped answering my texts. And they knew, and I was about to have my first of two surgeries. And they never got back to me and ghosted me completely. And we were about to look at getting a house in Huon and setting our lives up. And I was just like absolutely wrecked because I had no idea what was going on with my body. I felt horrible. I was so sick. I felt guilty because I couldn't be the person that they wanted because I was literally like, I have no energy. I'm constantly being sick. I can't, I'm not going out to dinner. Some nights we'll have a dinner reservation. I'll get there. And then all of a sudden I'll start nearly vomiting at the table. And I'm like, oh, we need to go. I'm so unwell. And then, yeah, it kind of broke me a little bit, which is good because it kind of was like, no, I need to have better self-worth and know who I am as a person. So I kind of built myself back up, got back into therapy regularly, talking through a lot of things that are like, actually, this is like, why did I put up with this? Why would I put up with this kind of behavior? And why would I sacrifice this for what? And why do I keep setting myself on fire for people who wouldn't piss on me to put me out? So it was kind of I never had any regrets from any of those relationships because it kind of got me to this point where now I'm like, nah, bang, bang, bang. And now I'm currently in a relationship and kids, and we have our ups and our downs, but we have a better way of communicating than in any other relationship. So if we're having problems, we can talk it through. And at the moment, we're kind of talking through different parts of being in an open relationship and being in a relationship where I wasn't expecting kids, but they came with as a package. So unfortunately, I had to kind of deal with it. And now we're like, it's been the longest relationship I've been in. It's 3.5 years now. And Josh has been a part of my life and he's a big part of the businesses and such. He's one of my biggest supporters. And it's I've never had someone in a relationship that was such a big cheerleader in that way, which made it really... he's very special. He's very special. And, yeah, it's nice. It's nice having a cheerleader who's always happy to kind of like go out of his way to help and do stuff as well. Just have to navigate in the joys of an open relationship. And, when we both have very different sexual needs as well, that makes it quite challenging. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where communication is so important.
It is, and that's, I think, where a lot of the stuff is. I'm like, well, I can't tell you no because I feel uncomfortable because I know you're going to feel like you're left out, you're missing out, and I can't. And because he was his first same-sex relationship after his divorce, and it's something that's going to be him navigating being a queer person. Now it's something that I can't exactly, I have a lot of guilt to be like, if I say no, it's going to neglect him from these aspects where I had the luxury of being sexually active for like 15 years, 16 years. So, wait, I need to do the math so it doesn't sound like I'm having We'll say 10 years. Just to be safe. 10, 15. But yeah, so I'm in a better place because I think having regular therapy has really helped because it kind of gives me an idea of where my own, and being diagnosed with borderline personality disorder gives me a lot of avenues to be like, oh, actually, no, that does make sense. Oh, no, having someone else who's an external person being like, I feel like this is happening. Okay, then talk to the person, do this. Like, my therapist is very good at being like, what would you tell your patients? Then do that. I'm like, oh, yeah, fair. that makes sense. Sorry.
All right, we should probably wrap up because we're running out of time. But
yeah, of course.
If you could go back to a teenage version of yourself, what message would you give them?
Oh, this is like Drag Race. I literally watched the final of season 16 before I came here. Like, what would you tell young Andrew? And it's funny because thinking about Drag Race and what I would do on there, and I'm like, okay, what would I do in that moment where they'll be like, what would you tell young Andrew, five-year-old Andrew or a teenage Andrew? And the more I think about it, the more I'm kind of like, don't say anything because if I change too much of the past, is it going to ruin where I am as the future? But because I don't want to say don't date this person or don't do this because all of these things, all the mistakes and the trauma and all the stuff that I've done in my past has led me to a point where I feel like I'm my most successful, happy, complicit kind of person. But the thing I want to kind of like reinforce is like I'm not alone. Hang in there. This too shall pass kind of thing. And it sounds so cliche, but it's like everything when I was younger, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be the worst thing ever. I'm going to get bullied at school. I'm going to get this. It's like, hang in there. hanging there is probably the biggest one, because it's just like, even with like, even now, I'm just like, oh my God, this feels like the worst thing in the world. This thing's happening, or this person's like out to get me, or this is happening. And it's like, no, ride the wave, stop letting the anxiety take control, and just live your life. Probably a thing I would tell my younger self is think of good self-protective strategies early now, before you get to your mid-30s, and then you're just like, oh, what do you do now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably the main thing. But otherwise, I don't want to change too... I wouldn't change too much, really. But I'll be loved, I think, is probably another thing as well. Even though if you don't feel it from your parents or your family, I'm still loved, and I'm still... You will have someone that will love you, whether it be a partner, which doesn't matter. Men are shit. But whether it be a community, whether it be fans, whether it be co-workers, there'll be so many people. Love is not just between your partner. There's so many different other forms of love. And you, just because you don't feel it from your family or your parents, it doesn't mean you can't get it from different avenues. Like crystal meth. No, I'm kidding. That's a joke. That is a joke. But there's so many other avenues you can get that outside of that. So don't be too hung up on that as well.
What's next?
We'll have a show in like 5 seconds. So like I need to glue my wig on, put my tits in, tuck my dick back. I'm making bigger and better events. So I did the Drag Ball, which was a Tasmanian drag festival last year, which was very, the most expensive and biggest thing I've ever run. It cost me like $21,000 to run it. And I know. I'm like, I'm an idiot. I'm so cooked. But it was so much fun, and I'm doing it again this year. But now I have another event that I'm going to probably do in January if I can get all my ducks in a line, which is probably going to be like $30,000. But it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's something I've been wanting to do for a while. And I really just want to kind of expand drag events and have like accessible ones, but also have really incredible, like massive big ones, which is going to be so much fun to do. Judy's is kicking on. We're doing a lot more competitions with the club, which is, I just want to make bigger and better events for Judy's, because I have so much fun with it. As much as it's annoying, it's giving a place for the community, which is so important right now, and so many spaces for drag performers. And I think the big thing that I'm really working on for this year and next year is I've been touring a lot around different parts of the country and trying to get different places so I can get gigs and get my name out there, because as much as I'm really bad with networking, so I'm trying to do that. But I have developing a solo show that I want to kind of tour around the state and then take it interstate as well, fingers crossed, and take it to fringe festivals. I think I have some connections at Adelaide Fringe and hopefully Perth Fringe, and set up a kind of one-woman show and... So that's, I'm going to get a couple of producers down here help me write it and develop it, which is going to be great, because I think it's going to be something that's going to be so much fun. And I love traveling, I love touring, and I love going to different places and just being like, here's my stupidity, enjoy. Don't take yourself too seriously. That's my message. That's my message to young Andrew. Don't take yourself too seriously. You're a you grow up to be a clown.
Awesome. Anything else?
If you want to see me on my website, www.pussypoppins.com, that's where you can find all of my upcoming events. And if you want to see me in a town close to you, if you want me to come to your town in rural Tasmania or wherever, let me know. I can always set up an event. You never know. But yeah, I'll be around. I'm going to be here for the long haul. So hopefully, unless my leg gets broken in the show in the next 20 minutes. Oh God, can you imagine? I'm just jinxed it. Shit.
Please, fuck me. Please don't break anything.
Future pussy, if something happens, you did it to yourself.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming in early to do this for us.
Thank you. No, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. Second time around as well. We recorded this 3 years ago and never got used. Bullshit.
If this episode has raised any issues for you, please take some time to reflect and ensure you reach out for support if you need it. If you are listening in Tasmania, you can contact Working It Out via their website or calling 6231 1200 during business hours. If you need immediate mental health support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224636. Both services are available 24/7. If you would like to get in touch or share your story on this podcast, please send us an email at nwpride@outlook.com. This podcast is produced by Northwest Pride, a community group based across the north, northwest and west coast of Tasmania. They host events and social inclusion opportunities for anyone who is a part of the LGBTIAQ plus community, their friends and allies. This podcast is made possible by the support of Working It Out. You can hear future episodes and all of our past episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please follow, rate, and review if you can. It does help us to reach more folks who might enjoy or benefit from hearing these amazing life stories. We'll be back soon. Take care of yourself and each other.